Anyone who is bilingual knows that you can speak two different languages and say the same basic thing. Each language adds nuance and layers of meaning to the other. Science and faith are two languages that can work together to say the same thing and add a depth of our understanding and experience of God. In this four-week series, we'll work toward becoming bilingual with our faith and science languages. In the end, we'll experience a richness in speaking both.
What are some of your favorite books or favorite authors, and especially maybe books or authors that you go to think about God, to think about faith and spirituality? Well, one author who has been really important to our family is Madeline L'Engle, and she's written all kinds of books, but maybe she's most known for A Wrinkle in Time. Here's what she says in one of her other books. When I try to find contemporary 20th century mystics to help me in my own search for meditation and contemplation, I turn to the cellular biologists and astrophysicists, for they're dealing with the nature of being itself, and their questions are theological ones. What is the nature of time, of creation, of life? What is human creativity? What is our share in God's work? Now, today we're going to read two books, and we're going to learn about God from both of them. Those two books are The Word and The World. Now, the word, is kind of a churchy word, like our last series, Churchy Words, but it's usually referred to in Christian circles as, well, the Bible, the Word of God. It's sort of short for the Word of God. But it goes even deeper than that. We read in John, one of Jesus' closest followers, his story of Jesus' life, and he begins it with this sort of expanding out to the whole universe. And he says, in the beginning, the Word already existed. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word of God, the Bible, points to the Word of God in the flesh, that is, Jesus. Paul, one of the first missionaries of the church, author of many of the books of the Bible, wrote this letter to the church in Colossians and said, Christ is the visible image of the invisible God. So that's one book, The Word. But the other book that we're going to read today, the second one, is The World. And one of my favorite psalms in the Bible, the psalms are kind of the prayer book of the Bible. One of my favorite psalms is Psalm 19. And I first really dug into that psalm because I loved backpacking in my youth. And I wanted to meditate on the Word without having to carry the weight of an actual physical Bible. So I memorized Psalm 19. And I love how it begins. You'll see exactly why it's a perfect verse to meditate on while you're backpacking. The heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims God's handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night declares knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard, yet their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. So that's one place in the Word, the Bible, where we read about the book of the world. There's another place, though, again, back to Paul in his letter to the Romans, where he says this. For ever since the world was created, people have seen the earth and sky. Through everything God made, they can clearly see God's invisible qualities, God's external power, God's eternal power and divine nature. So they have no excuse for not knowing God. God speaks not only in the Word, that is the Bible, and the Word in the flesh, Jesus, but God also speaks in the world. And as we're going to come to find in this series and in this message today, that God speaks science. Before we get to that, though, I have a chat question for you here. So turn to a neighbor or put your answer in the comments section to this question. We're going to get science geeky right now. How much did you love or hate your high school or college science classes, especially physics? Let's talk about it. One thing that I'm a bit of an armchair reader, I guess, is I'm an armchair astrophysicist. I know that sounds kind of crazy. Like most people say they're like an armchair quarterback but I'm an armchair astrophysicist. I love reading books about the beginning of the universe. And I love reading them because, well, I encounter God in reading the world. Now, I didn't go to school as a hard scientist or a physical scientist. I actually studied psychology, which is a social science. So I understand how science works. But I've read a lot about the beginning of the universe. So I'm going to share with you some of the things that have been helpful to me as a faith leader when I think about the beginnings of the universe. The current best theory, so to speak, of how the universe began is the Big Bang Theory. And no, I'm not talking about the show. I'm talking about a Big Bang explosion, where the universe began as this infinitesimally small, I can't even get it. You can't even describe it. It's so small. It's almost like everything that exists is in this little spot. And at some point it explodes. It goes boom. And out comes this whole universe that we live in. And it's like a balloon. Imagine with me a balloon right now. And on that balloon, there's dots all around it. And as you blow the balloon up, the universe is expanding and those dots are getting further and further apart from each other in this balloon. And that's how the universe began, with a Big Bang. Now, I grew up in a Christian tradition that looked at something like the Big Bang Theory, and they saw it as just another atheist theory for explaining how God didn't create the universe. But the actual reality of the history of science is the exact opposite. Materialistic scientists, and whether they were atheists or not, they wanted to just believe that the material world is all that there is. Materialistic scientists didn't like the Big Bang Theory. They didn't like the idea that the universe had a beginning. The basic way of thinking is that you can't get nothing from something. You can't have a time before time. The universe just had to exist as a static thing over, well, eternity. So let's take a little walk down the history of science and see what different key scientists said about this theory and how it developed. Sir Eddington, who was the first to prove Einstein's theory of relativity, said, "The notion of a beginning is repugnant to me. I simply do not believe that the present order of things started off with a bang. The expanding universe is preposterous, incredible. It leaves me cold." Walter Nernst, the German chemist who paved the way for the third law of thermodynamics, said, "To deny the infinite duration of time would be to betray the very foundations of science." I wish I could do a German accent, but, well, I'm gonna leave that for the actors. Vesto Slipher in 1912 was the first to notice the redshift in light from distant galaxies. This redshift is the light version of the Doppler effect. You know, when a car goes by you, or a race car, and it goes zoom, or like this. Now, Einstein, you know who Einstein is, right? Like MC squared. Einstein developed the theory of relativity. And Einstein believed in a static universe, that the universe wasn't expanding, it wasn't contracting, it just was. Einstein had a sit-down conversation with William de Sitter. Did you get what I did there? William de Sitter, sit down. They did it in 1916 during World War I. And Einstein said, "This circumstance irritates me. To admit such possibilities seems senseless." Einstein and de Sitter met in Holland at a cafe to sit down and to bait this out. Turns out that Einstein was wrong. In 1928, Edwin Hubble, who the Hubble telescope is named after, noticed through his telescopes that the universe was expanding, and not only expanding, it was accelerating in its expansion. If it was accelerating in its expansion, that meant that it wasn't going to collapse back in on itself. And if it couldn't collapse back in on itself, then one theory about how the universe could always exist was out the door. That theory was the oscillating universe, that the universe expanded, collapsed, expanded, collapsed. But the problem with that theory, of course, was that every time it collapsed and expanded, it would lose energy, and it couldn't go on forever. Am I starting to sound like your high school science teacher? We are getting kind of geeky, aren't we? By the way, who was your favorite high school science teacher? Mine was my physics teacher. I absolutely love that guy, although I can't remember his name. In 1927, the person who pulled all this data together, all these like disparate pieces of science together into a coherent theory of the Big Bang, was a guy named George Lemaître. Now, if you look real close at George Lemaître, notice what's around his neck. That's right, George Lemaître was a Catholic priest. It was a believer. It was a person who believed in God, who followed Jesus, who first came up with this theory of the beginning of the universe as the Big Bang. I love this meme of Einstein and Lemaître standing next to each other. Who's that standing next to the pioneering scientist who first proposed the Big Bang theory? Oh, that's Albert Einstein. Father Lemaître just convinced him. Here's how you know when a theory is really good. It's when it predicts that something will be there, and you go and look for it, and you find it there. And what the Big Bang theory proposed would be there was a bunch of background noise in the universe. And so, in 1965, Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson developed a scientific test to explore whether that background noise was there, and they found it. So here's what science tells us is going to happen with the universe at this point. It is going to continue to expand and expand, and the energy will continue to expand and be burnt out. And eventually, instead of a big crunch where it all comes back in on itself, what it is going to be a big freeze. The end of the universe is not going to be in hellfire and damnation. It's going to be in the cold and frozen universe. What we learn from all this is that this universe gets one shot. One shot. No, not that kind of shot. Our universe only had one opportunity to become what it is. The Big Bang was a singularity, a point at which nothing existed before it. Time began in this moment. And so maybe at this point we've reached as far back as science can tell us. Is this the end of science? Robert Jastrow, an astronomer and a believer, wrote a book called God and the Astronomers, and here's what he said. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. God speaks through the beginning of the world. Psalm 19 says, there is no speech, nor are there words, yet their voice goes out through all the earth. Science are those words, the words of God. We've been reading two books, The Word and the World. And in the world, we can see God in the scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe. Now, this doesn't prove that God exists. You can't prove that God exists. But it does give us some good reasons to believe that God exists. So let's stop right here and let's have a chat question. Again, turn to your neighbor, write your answer in the comments. Let's pause. What have you heard so far? What have you learned? What is still unclear? Let's talk about it. All right, we've been reading two books today, The Word and The World. And when we've been reading The World, what we've seen is the theory of the beginning of the universe. But another place that we can read the world and see God or understand something about God is what's called the fine-tuning of the universe. And sometimes it's referred to as the anthropic principle. And that's going to be really hard for the Gen Alpha and maybe some of the Gen Z to imagine this, but those of us who are at least Gen X and older remember an old school radio dial where you had to tune it one way or another And if you tuned it too far one way, you wouldn't hear anything. If you tuned it too far the other way, you wouldn't hear anything. But if you got the tuning just right, you'd hear the voice or the music come through the radio station. It had to be fine-tuned to be able to hear the voice. Well, it turns out that the universe is fine-tuned for all of us to exist. And here's what I mean by that. Plants can't survive without the sun. Plants can't survive without the atmosphere. You and I can't survive without the atmosphere. We can't survive without oxygen. The sun can't survive without the properties of matter being just the way that they are, so that it produces energy and light and heat. Imagine with me for a moment a metal ball that is perfectly held in the air between two magnets. If you move one magnet just a little closer, the ball will fall. If you move one magnet a little bit further apart, the ball will fall. The magnets have to be perfectly aligned to hold that ball in place. Now, there are forces in the universe that hold all matter together. In fact, there are 47 universal constants. So imagine now not just two magnets around that metal ball, but 47 magnets around that metal ball. All of those properties of those constants have to be just such for life to exist. Let's dig real deep into that right now. Let me give you an example of just one constant. It's called the ratio of electromagnetic force constant to the gravitational force constant. Do I have any idea what that means? No, but somebody smarter than me does. And it's one of the 47 things that has to be constant in our universe for life to exist. If this particular constant was altered by 1 in 10 to the 40th power, that's 10 times 10, 40 times. If it was altered by just that minute fraction of a little bit, stars couldn't produce helium. We wouldn't have nitrogen and oxygen. Carbon wouldn't form. All of these things that are necessary for life. All right, to give you a sense of how big this number really is, imagine with me for a minute stacking dimes. And we're going to start on the ground. We're going to stack one dime on top of another on top of another. I mean, a lot of dimes just to get up to me, right? But we're going to take those dimes all the way up to the moon. A stack of dimes that starts on the Earth and goes all the way to the moon. But that's not even enough dimes to get how big this number is, because you got to take the number of dimes and you have to multiply it by a billion. That's how big 1 times 10 to the 40th power is. And if one of those dimes was not a dime, but it was a nickel or a penny or a quarter, life couldn't exist. And we're just talking about one of 47 constants right now, all right? So the more improbable something is, the less likely it is to happen by chance, the less satisfying it is to explain it by chance. All right, let's add some complexity to the situation. Let's take, like, not instead of 47, let's just take 2 6-sided dice. And what are the chances that if you roll those 2 6-sided dice, that you get the same thing, like 2 sixes, for example? The chances of getting 2 sixes is 1 in 36 chances. Now, if you're not a stats person, statistics and probability may be a little bit opaque to you, but imagine with me for a moment a bag, and in that bag, there are 36 marbles. 35 of them are black and one of them is red. A 1 in 36 chance means that you put your hand in the bag and you pull out the one red marble. Now, it doesn't mean that you leave the marble on the side and you reach in again. No, you put the marble back in and then you reach in again. It's always 1 in 36 chance. All right, so what are the chances that you would roll the dice a second time and get 2 sixes? A 1 in 1,296 chance. How about 6 rolls and 6 times you get 2 sixes? A 1 in 2,176,782,336 chance. And we dumbed it down to 1 in 6. This is 1 in 47. There's 47 of these cosmological. I mean, the size of this number is astronomical. It's impossible for our minds to grasp how small of a chance this is that all of those 47 would be perfectly tuned for life to exist. This number is so big that I can't even tell it to you, but let's see if Google can. Hey Google, what is 6 to the 47th power written out?
The power power of a number indicates how many times the base would be multiplied by itself to reach the correct value.
Yeah.
Therefore, 6 to the power of 47 is 37420429515275954001453518729877918779136.
I haven't gotten into the full complexity of this number because the number is actually even bigger than that. Can you believe me? It's bigger than that. Everybody agrees. The number is 1 in 10 to the 154th power. That number is so big, I can't even get Google to say. I can't. I've tried. I used to. We did this in like an old sermon. Maybe Randy can find the video.
Google, what is 10 to the 154th power?
The answer is 99999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999
Okay, so scientists, rightfully so, don't want to posit God as the beginning of the universe, and they shouldn't. That's not what scientists do. If that's what they did, we wouldn't know everything we know about the universe today. So scientists continue to present theories or ideas about how we could have something that is so astronomically improbable take place. And the leading theory right now for how this all took place is what's called the multiverse. And now we're into superhero videos, right? Or Star Trek.
We exist in a universe which coexists with a multitude of others in the same physical space. At certain brief periods of time, an area of their space overlaps an area of ours. That is the time of interphase during which we can connect with the Defiance universe.
There are some problems with the multiverse. One of them is that it makes sense mathematically. If you have an infinite number of putting your hand into the bag and pulling out marbles, then an infinitesimally small probability is going to happen at some point. But that's a mathematical evidence. It's not actually real physical evidence. We don't have any real physical evidence of the multiverse. The second problem with this theory is that it still doesn't explain where the multiverse came from. So if we do find the multiverse, well, who made the multiverse? We've been reading the Book of the World to learn something about God today and how God speaks science. And I think we can see, not just from the Big Bang Theory, but we can see from the fine-tuning of the universe, we can see or hear the language of God. So let's stop and answer a question right now. Let's chat. Turn to your neighbor, write this in the comments section. Which one is more compelling to you? The Big Bang Theory, the beginning of the universe, or the fine-tuning theory, the anthropic principle? Let's talk about it. We've been reading two books today, The Word, that is the Bible, and The World, that is science. And what we've seen is that we can hear God's voice, not just in reading the Bible, but also in studying our world. Science is kind of like the words of God. I'd like to wrap up this whole exploration today of science by introducing you to a scientist who's really well-respected scientist, but also a person of faith. His name is John Polkinghorne. John Polkinghorne was a theoretical physicist, a theologian, and an Anglican priest. He was born on October 16th of 1930, and he got two PhDs, one in quantum field theory and the second in elementary particle physics, both of them from Cambridge. In 1979, he told everybody that he had, come to the conclusion of his research. He had done his best math in his youth. He wasn't going to do any more better math. So he quit his chair at the university. This is like, he's a tenured professor. He lets go of his chair and he goes back to theology school. In 1982, he was ordained and appointed to a church. In 1986, he was the dean and chaplain at Cambridge. In 1989 to 1996, he was the president of Queen's College, Cambridge. He wrote 5 books on physics and 26 books on science and religion. In 1997, he was knighted by the Queen, so he's technically Sir John Polkinghorne. And in 2002, he was awarded the Templeton Prize. He died on March 9th, 2021, just a couple of years ago. And recently I was watching a documentary where he was interviewed. And what he said, I think, does a great job of summing all of this up. Faith is a commitment to what you have motivations for believing to be true. Science involves faith of that sort. And reason involves faith, in my view, of a similar sort. And I want to try and show to my scientific friends that I have motivations for my religious beliefs just as I have for my scientific beliefs. Of course, there are different kinds of motivations because it's a different level of reality that's concerned. But faith is not something irrational. Faith is, in fact, the deepest rationality that one can attain to. The good news for us today is that science is not in opposition to faith. But rather, in science, we can hear the voice of God. And that's good news.